Okay, hi, my name is Mark Nelson. I am 40 years old, and today is Friday, March 21st, 2008, and we're sitting here in the StoryCorps booth at Grand Central Terminal, and I am interviewing a new friend of mine, Joshua Spafford. Joshua?
Hi there. I am the new friend. My name is Joshua Mark Hodel Spafford. I'm 35. I'm here with Mark on the same date, the 21st, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
In Grand Central. And I've recently met and befriended Mark Nelson. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'm really glad you called me. You called me out of the blue. And, you know, I was going to do this session today with my father, who got quite ill, and I was about to cancel. And then I thought, why not call Joshua? It's just seemed right somehow. I think
gutsy of you. Maybe or maybe not.
I don't know. I think my issues with my father are similar but different. I mean, he was a deeply loving man, deeply caring man, but also a very quiet man. Sort of the classic 40s absent. Not absent. He was always there for us, but not great at communicating with words.
Interesting.
And I think in many ways, your own story, the one we're going to talk about today, is kind of similar. Things that go unspoken, things that go unsaid. So let me just start with your grandfather.
Okay.
The guy who sort of, I think, is at the crux of all this.
Yes.
You're the grandson of George Hodel, who's become quite famous in recent years as a prime suspect in the murder of Elizabeth Short, who's also known as the Black Dahlia. That's correct?
I am George's grandson. Right. This is true.
So let me just give people that might listen to this sometime in the future a really quick sense of who George was. He was the son of George Hodel Sr., who was a banker, who appears in the United States sort of mysteriously in about, we think, around 1901 to 1904, somewhere in there. And then he moves to Los Angeles and somehow, I think, gets into the insurance business. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That sounds correct so far.
He marries a woman named Esther Hodel.
They may have been already married upon their arrival.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but yeah.
Okay. Then they have one boy, George Hodel Jr., who didn't go by George Hodel Jr., but just simply went by George Hodel. And he was born in 1907. And he has a sort of amazing pedigree, if you will. He was at the age of 9, he was performing a solo exercises of Massenet and Chaminade at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles, so under the headline of a child prodigy in music. And then in around the age of 13 or 14, he got chosen to be part of Lewis Terman's genetic study of genius, which we now sort of know colloquially as Terman's termites. And he actually faithfully fills out questionnaires that they send him into his 80s. And then in 1922, I just want to read something about from his 16th birthday. This is from the Los Angeles Times, October 15, 1922. Boy's home is planned by Russian. Famous architect decides to remain in city after completing work. Not many boys can boast that a famous architect came over from Russia to build them a house as a 15th birthday present. This was the distinction which fell upon young George Hill Hodel, who attained his 15th birthday on the 10th and fell heir that same day to a beautiful Swiss-Russian residence high on the hill at 6512 Walnut Hill Avenue, built and completed by M. Alexander Zelenko of Moscow to the day. So, he's quite a man. He's got an amazing pedigree. He's spoiled, probably, right?
Possibly, yeah.
And, so he goes on to have 5 children, Folly, 7 children. No, let me take this back. He goes on to have 11 children, including John Dion, who died.
Yeah.
And Steve Hodel is his son. And in 2003, Steve Hodel wrote a book called Black Dahlia Avenger, in which he essentially accused your grandfather of having murdered Elizabeth Short.
Yes.
So take me back to May 2003. You're walking along, you're minding your own business, you're doing whatever it is you do, and you see this book. What happens?
Yeah, that was a really intense moment for me. I'm entering my early 30s, and I'm in my own life negotiating my understanding and my relationship to the men who raised me, and going through some forgiving or at least some self analysis on what my own life had been, and I think that I was getting through that quite healthily and happily. And I'll never forget this. I had had a new girlfriend at the time, and she had been coming out of a recent divorce. And I said, well, we're a new relationship. Let's go back to meet my mom just for fun. And we go down to Florida where my mother lives. And the first thing that my mom says is, well, I've got to tell you, and mind you, my new girlfriend's in the car, there's been this book. And those words will always remain really ominous in my head now. And she proceeded to tell me what you know now, that Steve, my Uncle Steve, had come out with this book. Mm-hmm. And I could barely comprehend the reality that had been done, mm-hmm. the implications of
that
what
the book
it was,
had been written.
That he had written the book. Mm-hmm. I could barely grapple with it. Mm-hmm.
You were pissed off. I was
coping with a huge array of emotions, just disbelief, anger, mm-hmm. denial. Mm-hmm. And I was just fueled by so many questions. Mm-hmm. I spent the next few weeks really trying to work through my anger and surprise. Mm-hmm. And the next few years.
Well, let's back up just a second, because I think what's important for people in the future, if they listen to this, to also understand is that when he was being investigated for murdering Elizabeth Short, your grandfather suddenly left the country, and this was in, I believe, early 1951, or no, maybe, sorry, early 1950.
Yeah.
And he left behind a family in Los Angeles, a full family, quite a complete family. And then on top of that, he went to Hawaii and then the Philippines and had an entirely another family, a new family.
Yes.
Of which you're a part. So I'm just going to quickly go through that family tree real quick. So George has an illegitimate daughter, Folly, in 1926. And then he has Duncan in 1928. And then Tamar in 1935 by another woman, Dorothy Anthony. And then he marries your mom. And your mom was married to the film director, John Huston.
Not my mom. Steve's mom.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm sorry. It's all mixed up here.
Yeah.
Help me out here.
Here we go. So he now, George now marries Dorothy Harvey, who's had been John Huston, the film director's wife.
Right.
Right. And then he proceeds to have Michael, Calvin, Steve, and Steve has a twin who died.
John Dion.
Mm-hmm. That was his LA family,
right?
If you will,
right.
He,
bear in mind, I've been through this so many times. For so many years, it gets all messy for me.
And it's even in our own family, it's a lot to contend with.
So now he goes to the Philippines.
He goes through Hawaii. Terry, their first daughter, is born in Hawaii. Teresa. Mm-hmm. Then my mother, Diane, mm-hmm. and then Ramon. A boy, and then lastly, Mark,
right.
whom I'm named after. My name is Joshua Mark.
Right. So it's a big family.
And
if And anywhere you seem to go on this tree, you find some amazing stories in and of themselves. For example, Tamar's daughter, Fauna, was actually given up for adoption and then was raised in a black home. And then later in life made that story into a movie that made it all the way into a rough cut called Pretty Hattie's Baby that starred Jill Clayburgh and Charles S. Dutton and Tess Harper and Alfred Woodward.
Yeah.
Big, you know, some big name actors at the time.
Yeah.
And that movie was shut down for some suspicious reasons. And then over on your own side, you've got your own crazy story about your dad and your biological father and your... The man that raised you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I never knew my biological father. He was out of the picture even before I was born. My mother was very young when she had me. I believe she was 18. Mm-hmm. This was in Florida. My mother had me in Florida. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know him, and I was young enough, old enough rather, to know that I didn't have a father. I was about four, I guess. You know, you start to mm-hmm. become aware of what people are saying about you. When my mother, 3.5 or 4, remarried a very colorful man named Barry Deeney. Mm-hmm. Barry Deeney is a British citizen who had been born in the early 40s. And he was raised entertaining the Allied forces in Europe as a vaudevillian, as an acrobat, as a tap dancer. His parents were British and Australian vaudevillians. And when I say that, I say that with the understanding that this breed of old world performers lived hard and stern and colorfully. Mm-hmm. He never went to school, and he was proudly from the School of Hard Knocks. And while he had come up as a child performer tap dancing, he evolved himself into he had some modicum of success in Las Vegas as an entertainer, and he abandoned that to become a horse trainer, and then by his late 20s and early 30s he had styled himself into a sailor. Mm-hmm. He meets my mother in the early 70s in Florida, and they decide to have a romantic neo-bohemian sailing life. So
taking you on board with
taking
them,
me fully as a new romanticism, I guess, is the way mm-hmm. they always talked about it. So I was raised all over the world, and I'll try to condense this because it can get tricky. I was raised primarily between the States and the Far East, and specifically the Philippines, as two primary homes, with my grandmother and grandfather living in the Philippines, and I guess the States being as some kind of a home base to the series of sailboats, some of which were built by hand, and we spent time, well, over 12 years sailing around the world. Mm-hmm.
And so how does Barry get money for custom sailboats?
That's a great question. that's a good question. I know in some degree my grandmother, who should be talked about, Hortensia, a Filipino woman from a agricultural and political family in the Philippines, had been, in her time, from money, quite wealthy. And I know that some money was siphoned down to my mother mm-hmm. to fund this lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I also became aware as I grew up that my father, Barry, I'm calling my father, my stepfather, may or may not have been involved in perhaps some
contraband. Perhaps.
Contraband. Mm-hmm.
That's what sailboat smells like, right?
That's what sailboat smells like. Mm-hmm. I can say for certain that in 1980, he went to Cuba with my family, mm-hmm. my mother, and they helped contraband people mm-hmm. over to the States, the Mariel boat lift mm-hmm. in 1980 mm-hmm. between the administrations of Carter and Reagan. Mm-hmm. They thought they were doing a good thing, and perhaps mm-hmm. they were. Yeah.
Fascinating. It's just, there's another little twist there.
Yeah. It's curious for me to talk about Barry in relationship to George, because it's a connection that I've been thinking about a lot of my own life. Mm-hmm. It's probably more as a character study for myself. George and Barry knew each other, and I'd always been curious as to why, at least outwardly, George maybe even liked Barry, or at least approved of his relationship with my mother. And on the surface, they couldn't have been more different, where George was urbane and withholding and sophisticated, genteel, and rich. Barry was not. He was energetic, a working-class Cockney, some could say, colorful, sort of self-styled Errol Flynn, lived by the seat of his pants in the moment, kind of guy, double make hair sort of personality, and quite conflicted. Certainly a world-class alcoholic and womanizer.
In a weird way, it seems almost natural that he would have liked him. I mean, in a way that while he had those more polished qualities, it seems that he also had the ability to basically convince anybody of anything and just pick up and go when he needed to.
Without question, that's true.
Leave a whole family behind and start a whole nother one.
This is totally true. And in speaking about it right now, it's becoming even more focused. And that's something Barry had done in his own life, too. He had had a family, if not two, before ours. I've been working on a play, and maybe we can talk about that or not later, but I've been looking at these two characters, kind of male, iconic, masculine characters as two sides of a kind of a similar coin in a weird way. But I don't know,
maybe both. Maybe both. Maybe wanting a little of what the other had or something.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit more about your grandma then, Hortensia. Because
equally as remarkable to me, as George, is Hortensia, Laguda, later Hodel, later Stark, who was the child of relative Philippine aristocracy, Chinese Filipino stock. And she, at a very early age, decided to leave the Philippines and see the world. And I have to remember, this is the 30s.
That would have been difficult for
difficult,
a woman.
Quite unheard of. She traveled the world independently. She went to Juilliard to study piano. And she styled herself into a cosmopolitan woman of the world. And this is, to me, remarkable, given the time. She would later marry George and become a very successful agriculturalist, a sugar cane plantation owner.
So then I imagine she would have been...
And later a two-term congresswoman.
Okay, right. So I would imagine that she would have been close to the Marcoses, maybe, or...
She was on the opposite side of that fence. She was a big part of the political force in his downfall, yeah.
Oh, I see, okay. Yeah. On the opposite side.
Yeah.
But certainly they must have maybe rubbed shoulders early
Without
on.
Question, okay. the elite families of the Philippines... We're all related, certainly, and and yeah, they all knew each other.
Interesting.
I've been to those houses with shoes.
Okay, so let's go back to George then for a little bit. So you're a boy. You're growing up sometimes in the Philippines, sometimes not. But tell me about your grandfather. What was he like as a boy? Go back to being a boy for a minute.
Sure.
Not now. You're not here in the present. You're a boy now. You're just. Here's granddad.
I remember meeting him even before, I want to say, I met Barry, which is true. And the story is I was shipped off to the Philippines for a stay with him. And the story goes that I get off the plane and I see him. And I say, "Hi, are you my daddy?" And apparently he just laughs. But I certainly had... I've always had, from boyhood, a strong feeling that he filled a father role in my life. As a very young boy, you know, you understand by the way other people treat him that he was a very important person. He lived in lavish surroundings. He lived in the penthouse suite of a tall building with large, rich artifacts of the world, Buddhas and statues and paintings by Man Ray, and just, it was like a castle. And the way people treated me as his grandson was something like a little prince. Mm-hmm. And you understand that from a young age. You get it. You put it together. So I guess I felt very lucky and privileged, and I would clamor for his attention and affection. Mm-hmm. And I remember this distinctly because my grandmother, for example, sort of coddled me and held me a lot, and it was very easy, where as a young boy, I'd have to work for his attention. Mm-hmm. And I would get it, but when I did, I was very proud because people would seem to be impressed. Mm-hmm. That's from a very young boyhood, mm-hmm. and that relationship would evolve through my teens and to my early 20s at different stages. I had always been told that, oh, you're his favorite grandson. And I'm sure that every grandchild had been told that, of course. But I took that to heart, and I took a lot of pride mm-hmm. in that, and I valued my time with him, and people would always reassure me that I had a lot of the same qualities, whatever those were. I speak many languages, and I think George spoke a few himself, and he would be constantly be giving me IQ tests. That was his thing every year, a new IQ test, and he would assure me that I was close to the genius, but mm-hmm. he was keep more than track. A genius. So it was very important to me that he loved me, because I understood and I saw that his love or the affection he showed outwardly was monitored, certainly. Mm-hmm. It could be said he was cold and exacting. Some of his kids might say that. Mm-hmm. So I was fiercely proud mm-hmm. that he seemed to take an interest. When I was 15, he mm-hmm. took me into his company and hired me mm-hmm. as an employee in his market research company at first as data entry, but later as an interpreter. Mm-hmm. I would translate documents from different languages, Dutch and Danish and mm-hmm. Filipino into English, and he was proud, mm-hmm. I think. And yeah. I was proud to have him proud. that changed.
Well, tell me, how has it changed? I mean, where are you with it now?
Well, the publication of Steve's book, Steve Hodell, mm-hmm. We've mentioned the name of
course,
his book,
yeah.
The Black Dahlia Avenger. Mm-hmm. And even, I'd say even to a larger degree, even your own book that you published, Exquisite Corpse, which, correct me if I'm not encapsulating the idea correctly, but it seems to be a furthering of some of his ideas and an expansion on them, and
it's a cautious support, I would say.
Okay.
It's with we have our own thesis.
Yeah.
We don't know whether or not your grandfather killed the Black Dahlia.
You should mention, in saying we, it's...
Yes. My co-author, Sarah Hudson Bayless, and myself are pretty clear throughout the book that yep. we don't know the answer. Yep. And we don't believe that anyone does, and we are pretty certain that no one is ever really going to know for sure.
Yeah.
But the thesis, generally speaking, is that, well, we know that your grandfather was deeply interested in surrealism. We know that for a fact.
Yeah.
We know that he was probably what you might now think of as a pathological abuser of women.
Yeah.
And we know that's in a myriad of different ways, from the oral and from the written record. We know that he was a close friend of the surrealist photographer Man Ray,
yeah.
and we can document that.
Yeah.
We also know that although he was the chief venereal disease specialist, that he was also very adept at surgery, and in fact his resume lists many incidences of being actually a surgeon. So, you know, some skeptics have said, well, he was a venereal disease specialist. He couldn't have done this. And we can say with authority that technically speaking, he could have.
Right. Right.
He had the skills to do so. Right. But all of that builds around our thesis, which is basically that given all these things together, we think that maybe he was copying surrealist art. A lot of people have looked at the body of Elizabeth Short, dead on the ground, and thought that this murder is more special than any other murder, not in as much as who was lost, as in the person that was lost, since all murder is terrible, but rather the specifics around how her body was arranged and what was done to it and how it was found, and that it looks to have been posed very specifically and damaged very specifically by our thesis in a manner that is after surrealism, if you will. And then we go on, the second part of our thesis is basically to say that possibly, and this is a little more murky, some of the surrealist pals might have gotten hold of the crime scene photographs, which is not a huge leap, and maybe made art to then re-reflect the murder again. So it's a two-part thesis. And, you know, we take a lot of issue with Steve's facts. You know, we're very cautious with them, which ones we believe and which ones... Generally, if it's in the oral record of other people besides Steve, or if it's in the written record, we tended to be okay with it. If it's Steve drawing inferences or conjecture off of certain things that are facts, yes, but are very malleable facts, then we kind of part ways with him. For example, we're not really convinced that he killed as many women as Steve makes out in his book.
Yeah.
So I hope that answers that question.
Sure. I was curious to meet you, actually, mm-hmm. When I heard about your book. And I'll go back and say that my feelings about what has transpired, about these accusations on my grandfather, have evolved a lot mm-hmm. since 2003 mm-hmm. and continue to evolve. And it started with just a complete rejection of these ideas. Mm-hmm. They have gone to complete acceptance of these ideas. Mm-hmm. And I hope that I'm arriving at some comfort in not knowing.
Yeah.
But I think that's been really hard.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest place to be. It's that, and it's what I would advise you to try to find, which is basically, I think you should take from myself and Sarah that we don't know. We wrote a whole book about it, and we don't know. And I hope that offers you some kind of comfort in the sense that we are not willing to say, after thoroughly researching this for a very long time, that we know the answer. And like I said before, I don't know that we'll find that answer. I will say that as a sort of exact, I think the reason we've sort of hit it off in a way is that our stories kind of mirror each other. When Steve's book came out, I had the exact opposite reaction, which is, oh my God, what an amazing story. I mean, this is incredible, blah, 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 and I got to go buy this book. And I read it the way you read maybe a dime store novel, really fast and breezing over things that I knew were, let's say, light on, factually light, you know.
Yeah.
And accepting to a certain degree the incredible story, because it is an incredible story. I mean, it's populated by incredible people, but sort of letting the facts slip by. And it wasn't until November 2004 after I had already formulated the surrealist aspect of the thesis, where I felt like I really, if I was going to move forward and actually write the book, that I had to stop and I had to say, now, wait a minute, let's go back to Steve's book and let's take it apart like a car engine, you know, and say which parts are really making this book run, you know. And and luckily the expanded edition in 2004 that sort of comes out with the Lillian Lenorak episode and the DA transcripts, which amazingly were not even in the first book, those are the things that allowed me to continue. And I've got to say that the third revised edition, you know, I can't say strong enough that there's a lot of crap in there that I just don't agree with, and I actually advised Steve not to put in,
really,
which he did anyway. But you know him; he's sort of loose. He just sort of throws it out there and sees what sticks.
I feel like it it weakens his own argument.
It does. He needs an editor. Yeah, he needs an editor, a better editor, you know.
While it's on my mind, what's remarkable to me is that before I became aware of your book, right, I've been processing this whole event through my wife, Jill. Mm-hmm. And I'm an actor and a photographer, mm-hmm. and you know, the way I thought to cope with it is to tell a story about it. I'm a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And we had bandied about ideas on how that might happen. And in re-examining Steve's book, even before we heard about your project, the one thing that I felt and she felt that could make his ideas plausible and feasible was his connection and his fascination and relationship to art, mm-hmm. and surrealism and Man Ray. And it had been those ideas that had been nagging at me, mm-hmm. and really disturbing me, because there seemed to be some plausible connections there.
Can I just interject one quick thing there? I think that when you're thinking, as you go on thinking about that more, what you should sort of understand about surrealism is that surrealism had 20 years from roughly 1924 then up to the time of the murder, about 23 years more or less, to really go through all of the cycles of its own life. It was the singular and most important art movement of the 20th century, probably one of them, certainly. And the amount of information that is there to anyone that wants to look into surrealism and what they were about is just massive.
Yeah.
And by the time of the murder, surrealism had sort of become a kind of a cliche in a way.
It was part of
the broader American consciousness, and it was starting to be in advertising, and it was Dolly and Life magazine. You know, it was everywhere.
Dolly and Disney.
Yeah, exactly. Dolly and Disney. Dolly and and Alfred Hitchcock. And and so 2 years prior to the Black Dahlia murder, there you have a Dolly picture in Life magazine of a girl cut in half. So, you know, this is in the public consciousness. It's not just this. We're not just saying in our book, for example, that he saw one picture and copied it. We're not really saying that. What we're saying was he was influenced. He was maybe, let me qualify that, maybe influenced and inspired by something that was essentially ubiquitous by that point. So I didn't mean to cut you off.
But, I intended to ask you about that anyways, to fill me in a bit more about the history and context of surrealism. But just to finish that thought off, it was the hook to which I remained curious about. And I thought if there is any feasibility to the story, it's going to be there.
Right.
That's the hook. Knowing my grandfather the way I did, mm-hmm. With his keen interest in art, his history of his.
So he would talk about it all the time, art and.
And it was an active part of our life. Mm-hmm. Having art in our life and styling ourselves. We've all been encouraged to pursue our mm-hmm. creative endeavors wholeheartedly, even though my family, many members have been led successful careers in medicine and politics. If anyone has said, I have a creative inclination, then it's been wholeheartedly supported, as mine have, and certainly by him. He always encouraged me to be a photographer, to be an actor. And he was something of a self-styled photographer himself. Right. And I've never met a family whose family is more well documented in pictures than my own, starting with him, mm-hmm. his own life, my mother's life, my life. It's every day has been taken up in pictures. Mm. And his relationship with Man Ray in particular and John Huston, it's well known in our family and it's always been a source of pride mm-hmm. to everyone. So that seeing and reading your book before I met you really affected me a lot. In fact, I could go as far as to say that it affected me as much as Steve's book in many ways. It's because it's a more cohesive argument, I think. He throws a broad net, mm-hmm. and he tackles many points and you guys have focused your point and really gone after it. And the book itself is beautiful. I want to say that it's a beautiful book. But its arguments, you know, are strong, and it's been disturbing to me to come to terms with the fact that he really might have done it.
Yeah. Well, let me just say that, so how we got in contact in the first place was you called me out of the blue and said, you know, I'm Joshua Spafford, I'm George Hodel's grandson. And bizarrely, this has actually happened to me a couple of times with other people.
Yeah.
I don't have time to go into that. But,
yeah.
You said, you know, I'm a professional working actor in New York City, and actually it's hard to remember sometimes that there are such a thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's the old joke about all the waiters and whatnot.
Sure.
But, you know, of course, the first thing I did was I Googled you, you know, and found out that indeed, wow, you know, you've been in plays and been, you know, on the New York Times and reviewed and stuff. And you said, come see my play. I've written a play about George Hodel.
To be clear, I just want to say I commissioned this project.
You commissioned it, right?
And you're right. I commissioned and created it with a playwright.
Right.
To help me remain.
And his name again is?
P. Seth Bower.
P. Seth Bower. So you said, come see my play. And I thought, oh my God, another Black Dahlia. I can't take it anymore. Blah, blah, blah. And I went with Sarah, and I went with low expectations, I've got to say. I went thinking I was going to see a schlock fest, but actually Sarah was very game and very excited to come. And her excitement actually made me want to come, you know.
Yeah.
And I was really surprised. I thought the play was good in a way that I didn't expect, and it made me it's the old, you know, the cliche, like, it made me laugh, it made me cry.
Right.
You know? No, but it made me think that you really, you don't treat Steve very sympathetically in the play. He's sort of a foil, if you will, but I think you're using him in a way to come to your own realization at the end.
I know we have limited time here, but I had hoped that functionally he might be the antagonist, but I had hoped that we created, albeit a fictional, I mean, these are based on people, but it is a fiction still, that we created a human being, you know, we've taken pains to make sure that everyone has their version and their reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the end, the playwright gives him a speech about his own feelings about abandonment.
Right.
And what I dread, and what I've had to come to terms with, is I have a lot in common with Steve.
Mm. And what about with George, then,
and
by extension?
And with George. And Steve and I have experienced some similar ideas, and that is, did you love me enough?
Right.
I think. I'm surmising that, but I've certainly felt that. You know, I want more of your love, and I want you to claim me more, and why didn't you do that?
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of people say that it was a daddy dearest scenario, and he takes great offense at that and says he loves his father dearly, and I can't even pretend to imagine what kind of is really going on with his book and what he's talking about with his dad there, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously the issues are huge.
Towards the end of his life, he and Steve were really quite close.
Mm-hmm.
So that this should happen right after George's death is...
Do you ever get the feeling that maybe something was going on there at the end, like George wanted to tell Steve something, maybe didn't come out and say it outright, but started pointing him down certain back alleys?
I see George in his last 2 years as opening up in ways that he'd never done before.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting idea, what you're saying.
I have no idea. I'm just throwing it out there.
You know, like he admitted to folly.
Mm-hmm.
Only much, 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 much later in his life, towards the very end.
Right.
I don't know.
Okay.
That's it.
Do we have any time left? 1 minute? 1 minute, okay, what can you do with a minute? Yeah, you know, it's all through interviewing your family, I just, the stories that come down from George, for example, Tamar's, the incest trial that, you know, he was accused of and ultimately acquitted of having incestuous relationships with his daughter Tamar. Although, when I listen to her, I can't help but think she's telling the truth, even though she was called a liar at the time. I mean, the man just left behind a wake, you know, and it's very complicated.
I've just been pressing my own family, my mother and my grandmother, for more information. My grandmother was house in that time.
Yeah. Do you fight with her, Grandma?
I don't fight with her, but I press her, and it's delicate.
Well, yeah, delicate. I imagine, yeah.
And they will say mistakes were made.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, whatever that means.
Well, people have a lot to protect in their past. I don't mean that in, like, that she's protecting him. I just simply mean that your past is a tender thing. You know, you don't often think it's the right of someone else to come and start dredging it up.
Yeah.
Whatever is back there, you know.
Right. Like a house of cards or dominoes. Like, if, you know, what if one aspect of any of these things were true? How does that then affect all of us?
Exactly.
And the way we are viewed, primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And the ethics and morals which we were handed. How do these stand in light of all this? That's, to me, the most disturbing aspect.
Right.
I was always, I hate to say this, I was encouraged to be a womanizer, I think, by all my father figures, George included. Mm-hmm. Oh, the girl, love the girls and they'll love you.
Mm-hmm.
Ha ha.
Mm-hmm.
And I as a young man, I sort of laughed about that and I was really cavalier about the whole thing. And I look at that now and I go, well, if what he did was true and this, my own behavior was encouraged, I get sickened. Yeah. I get sickened thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of off tangent.
All right. We're out of time.